In the last episode, we looked at therapeutic schools and treatment centers for students with alternative psych profiles and difficulty with substance abuse. We now turn our attention to the placement of students transitioning out of treatment and into traditional college, or perhaps non-traditional college. I'll be joined by Megan Leahy of Steinbrecher & Partners. Megan Leahy joined Steinbrecher & Partners after 9 years at Mamaroneck High School, where she worked successfully with students and their families as a school counselor. During her tenure at Mamaroneck, Megan designed a multi-session program and handbook for college-bound students and their parents. She also gave numerous presentations on navigating high school successfully, college readiness, and finding the right fit. In addition, Megan ran 2 comprehensive school leadership programs, Caprice Advisors and Peer Leaders, helping scores of students develop their talents and abilities. Megan is a certified school counselor. She holds an Ed.M. and an MA in counseling psychology from Teachers College, Columbia University, and an AB in psychology from Smith College. She also holds certificates in conflict resolution and peer mediation. Megan has appeared as an educational expert on both radio shows and financial planning webinars, and has been featured as a presenter at professional conferences. Megan, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to have you here today.
Thanks for having me.
So, could you explain your sort of background and specifically how you got into educational consulting?
Sure, absolutely. I'm trying to figure out where to jump in. But essentially, I started my career working with city kids. I worked at a school called City of School. It was a second chance school for kids kicked out of mainstream. So I worked with a lot of like teen parents and gang affiliated students and unhoused students. And so it was awesome and I loved it. But I also, there were a lot of limits to what we could do based on the way the system was set up. And so I decided to move out to Westchester, where I thought there would be a really nice tax base to support some of the programming that we wanted to do. And so I ended up working at Mamaroneck High School, which is a really cool district. It pulls from a bunch of different towns with a really different socioeconomic base. And so I felt like that was a great spot for me to land. And I worked with all different kinds of students in that situation. I definitely worked with a lot of ESL students, students who were struggling. We weren't grouped by our last name. And so they would, you know, the first trans kid who came through was mine. Anybody with kind of budding personality stuff, that was mine. What was then known as Asperger's, now ASD spectrum, those students started coming through. They became my students. And so, yeah, I was in it.
So you were the person for those sort of fringe kids.
Yeah. But I also had a number of really traditional tracked students. I coached a number of sports. So I had my finger in both worlds. But I loved my students for whom public education was not an easy road. Those were definitely the bread and butter of what I love to do. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I got not burned out. That would be the wrong word. But I got frustrated with the system that wasn't providing enough for those students. And there was really a dead end, right? We could provide.
How many kids did you have?
180.
That's a lot.
That's a lot.
Even track all those names. I mean, wow.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a lot. And I loved the lotness of it. You know, I would go in very early and leave very late. But for students who were really struggling, you know, we had a number of students who were physically cutting in bathrooms and, you know, struggling to maintain emotional regulation in the school day. And there weren't a lot of great options for where they could go. And so I found a woman who was doing it in the community, who was doing what I now do, right? Really looking for placements for students that gave them access to education or gave them better skills. And so I knew I wanted to ultimately do something like that, but I wasn't sure I was ready to go into the private sector. You know, there's pluses and minuses to it. So,
what was your hesitation?
Private behavioral health is incredibly expensive. And so just by switching to that you are still limiting the people you can help. You are helping a lot of people, but there's a big portion of the community that just can't afford private behavioral health. And there is a real switch in the industry, and we can talk about that. There's an increase in insurance-based programming. More and more private behavioral health organizations are realizing that it was limiting in access. But it's still like everything, right? There's pluses and minuses.
So they're accepting more scholarships and taking more forms of insurance?
So they're taking more forms of insurance. Scholarship money is still a really hard. There is some out there, but it's not as prevalent as I would hope it would be. And I think, I mean, this is a bit of a tangent, but I think the lovely thing about insurance is that more people have some sort of insurance plan that they can use to access mental health services. Mm-hmm. I think the downside is that you are then beholden to insurance. Mm-hmm. And so if I have a private pay client, we get to decide when that person is ready to move on to the next level of care. And if you're using your insurance, they are determining when you are ready.
Bureaucracy. God bless.
Yeah. And it's sometimes heartbreaking. Like I had a student who was being treated for a particular disorder, and the facility that she was in and the psychiatrist who was treating her kept saying, she's not ready. She's not ready. And her insurance said, no, she's ready for the step down level of care. Like we are done doing residential. She will now get, PHP and then IOP. It is their goal to move you through the stages of care. So that was a big tangent, but that's essentially the plus and minus of working in a school system and helping, everybody with varying amounts of needs and switching to private industry where you really are maybe the top 5%. It's not only the top 1%, but it's a financial struggle for many families to treat their students privately. But I made the transition and I love it. I am super happy. Yeah. And usually when people find me, they're like, I wish I had known you existed earlier, right? They've done so many things and tried so many things. And so,
well, earlier, you mean because they catch you like around junior, senior year?
They catch us whenever, but it's usually, we're a profession that you don't know we exist until you need to know we exist. And as much as we try to get out and talk and not many people are going to show up to a needs-based talk until they need it.
Well, yeah.
And so 99% of my business is word of mouth or referrals from local providers. And so when parents get to me, they're like, oh, I wish we had known. It would have been so nice to have somebody help us navigate the journey.
Right. So, I mean, ideally, when would you start with a kid like that in terms of their schooling career?
So it really depends on when the struggles are appearing. We work with students as young as 10, and those tend to be students for whom, they're not really succeeding in their school environment, but they have potential. And the parents know that ultimately they want their student to be higher ed bound, right? That's a goal for the family. Right. And so it becomes, if, especially in this environment, if I step off the track, how do I get back on, right? Like if we do this pause to make sure our student has the skills and, what they need to be successful, not academic or academic and social emotional, all of it kind of combined, they want to make sure that they're not ruining, quote unquote, ruining the kid's future.
Right. Of course. Absolutely. So we brought up sort of Steinbrecher. What makes Steinbrecher a unique organization? I mean, how would you describe its core?
So it's a great question. And I think it's a great question because I feel like I have a great answer, which is Phyllis Steinbrecher started it back in the 1970s. And we really keep her legacy alive. She started it and her goal was that nobody would walk through the door that wouldn't be helped. So at that point, she was one woman doing traditional college, therapeutic placement, and day in boarding school. And there was no internet. So you really did need her guidance on all of those things. And the firm kind of grew from that, which was that we want to meet students and families where they're at and be able to help and serve them in a way where they grow and become who they want to be. And that's been our core forever. We're never pushing an agenda. Our agenda is their agenda. That's so cool. Yeah, it's awesome. it's been a really great experience. And I've kind of worked my way up. You know, I came in 08, and then I became a partner, and then a senior partner. So
how many senior partners are there?
Two of us.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah.
All right.
And the cool. other one is 80.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Oh, really? Is that Deidre?
Yes.
He's 80?
Yes.
He doesn't look 80 at all.
Amazing.
Whoa.
He's looked that same way. I've known him for 16 years. He hasn't changed one bit.
I would have guessed like 60. That's crazy.
He's amazing.
Must have a great like health routine or something. That's
an avid cyclist.
Oh, okay. All right. All right. That explains it. Those guys are hardcore. All right. Cool. So you'd say that's still kind of your core philosophy? Like you don't turn anybody away?
Here's what I would say. If you're not appropriate for us, we're going to put you with the person who's appropriate, right? We are designed for students who are higher ed bound or who are in higher ed and need a break. So if there is a student who will struggle long term with mm-hmm. independence, that's just not a client that we are equipped to gotcha. Serve.
So more like severe mental illness or incapacity.
Developmental disability. Yeah.
Yeah.
Gotcha. ID. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But other than that, you are serving.
So other than that, we feel like, so we have some consultants who specialize in traditional day and boarding school, traditional, gotcha. Like, so the whole gamut, traditional law right. and sure. business grad school, traditional college, mm-hmm. and then we have the non-traditional track for, right. for people who maybe don't fall within that
right.
path.
And secondary school, right? And primary mm-hmm. school, right?
Yep.
Okay, cool. Thanks. That is a good, that's a good question. I mean, I feel like a lot of consultants do struggle to answer that question because I guess there is a bit of a genericness to things, particularly, I guess, if you're just kind of focused on college. I think a lot of consultants are just like, oh, we do college and that's it. So what type of student do you see most frequently there?
So I have a hybrid practice of traditional and non-traditional college-bound students, and I love that balance. It kind of mimics what I did on a smaller scale in public school, and I love it because the conversations are different, and yet they're so much the same, right? It's a lot of talk about who do you want to be? What's important to you? How do you align your interests with what your core beliefs are? All that stuff. It's right. the same whether you're talking to somebody who's going through treatment or you're talking to a junior who, you know, plays field hockey and hasn't really expanded who they are yet.
Right. Yeah. So what's your favorite type of case?
I love a project.
All right. And what does that mean to you?
So I like solving problems, right? Because as you said, if you're just a traditional college counselor, there is a roteness to it, right? Yeah. Oh, it's January. You're going to fill out your questionnaire. And that's fine. That's really nice to have a structured calendar. And some people absolutely love that.
Right.
I feel
and that
like
has to be part of it.
You've got boxes to check, right? Yeah. But we're yeah. so highly individualized that we have boxes to check, but they could be checked in any order based on what the student's needs are. So I think my favorite part of the whole process is working with the student to kind of start to pull the string, right? Like, how do we figure out who you are in the grand scheme of things right now? And I'm always big with kids, like, it's right now. It's not when you're 25. It's not even when you're 21. It's like, right now, where are you at? And so when I say solve it, it's like we get to weed through all this stuff, whether, again, whether they're therapeutic or traditional, to kind of drill down on their essence.
So, I mean, with college kids in particular, mm-hmm. when would you ideally like to start with those kids? I mean, are we talking about ninth grade? Are we talking about 10th? Like, when do you want to start?
I like to start, I would say, on average, I will meet with a sophomore one time before they're choosing junior year to look at what they've done so far. I don't believe in a highly curated high school experience. So I feel like halfway yeah. through sophomore year, they've kind of like, maybe they've gotten involved in everything. Maybe they've gotten involved in nothing. And that's right. really good data to start to look at and say, okay, like let's dig in and let's look at your courses for junior year, where in most schools, that's the first time you have a significant amount of control over what you're taking. And how does that align with your interests and what you're doing outside of the school day? So anyway, long and short, once as a sophomore, definitely either end of sophomore year or before junior year begins is where we really start to dig in.
So I've had some counselors say, you know, I want to start with them in eighth grade. And, you know, we're going to build out their extracurriculars, find out, you know, some contests and can they start some businesses, like, you know, the whole nine yards. Some of them are like, I only start with eighth graders or ninth graders. Yeah. Then I get booked up. So I'm curious why you're sort of on the opposite end of the spectrum. And what's your rationale for
that? That's a really good question. And I think short of a math track in eighth grade, I don't think there's a huge value add, right? The math track you choose in eighth grade really does set your math course. We can still fix it, but you start to march along that path. I think other than that, when we start saying to people, you have to participate in this program. I just had a person call me the other day and said, does my child have to do a research paper over the summer? And I said, why on earth would they write a research paper over the summer? Like, no, it's their summer. Should they do something interesting that they're excited about? Yeah. I doubt that that's what really is getting them super pumped about summer vacation. Yeah. So I think when we start to be prescriptive about what people should do, and I say to my students all the time, there is no should in my office, right? People say, I should volunteer. I should. There's no should. Like, let's figure out what you want to do and why you want to do it, and we'll go from there. So I guess I don't love prescription. I think kids are kids. I think you can get into amazing colleges that are appropriate for every student without forcing yourself into a contorted box that's not who you authentically are.
Starting nonprofits and curing cancer.
Because it's so transparent, right? When you sit on the other end of it, the kid that legitimately did those things, it is clear. The kid that fabricated them or did them because some person told them they should, it is also so clear.
Yeah, those expectations that are ramped up in earlier ages. Do you find that you need to sort of battle against that then when you're telling them to kind of take it easy, take their time and, like, you know, sincerely and develop actual interest?
Yeah, be authentic. You know, I would say it's a mix. Sometimes I'm battling the student who's been told by their friends that they have to do these things. Sometimes I'm battling the parent or one parent or two parents who, you know, have heard that these are the things you have to do. So there is a little bit of that, but more so it's just education. It's more talking to them. So my speech that I give all my kids is you get to do high school one time, right? And anybody who's worked with me hears this speech. Like, one time, you get your driver's license one time. Maybe you go to junior prom one time. That's your own. Like, you can go to other people's. And so if we are so future focused, you're missing out on all of the reasons why high school exists. So it's a little Pollyanna-ish of me, but I feel like it's the only way we can combat kids in ninth grade saying, I'm going to blank. Well, like, you don't even know yet who you are. Like, you might, you could, there's nothing that says you shouldn't.
Right.
So I talk to my students about creating opportunities, right? Like, get the best grades you can because that creates the most opportunities. Take the courses that are interesting and challenging to you because that creates the best opportunities.
Here are a few things that stuck out to me after the first segment of my conversation with Megan. I think it's pretty interesting that they only recommend starting with, really, she said, one session potentially with a sophomore in high school. And then really, they don't kick it up into gear until we're talking about junior and senior years. After having interviewed a great number of educational consultants, I would say that this sort of falls on the end of the spectrum that I would perhaps label as late starting. And they have a very specific reason for doing that that I found interesting. Essentially, not to put the pressure on a kid to bloom and become some sort of sincere and perfect product at the age of 14. Certainly, there is some sense to this. If we think about it in terms of common sense, kids at that age haven't discovered what they want to do with themselves. They certainly don't know. They haven't experienced enough of the world to be able to say, I am this or I am that. So asking them to do that at such a young age, congeal into some sort of final product, is a little ludicrous. That being said, there are big battles to fight there in terms of resisting the world's expectations, the world expecting kids to be increasingly sort of niche and focused on one in particular activity or sport or whatever that thing may be for them. Certainly, colleges are looking for a well-rounded product in terms of service community and sincere, actually, commitment to things like clubs and sports and games, that sort of thing. But I think perhaps that's a noble battle, and I wonder how well it's going. The second thing that stuck out to me was her description of her caseload. I don't think those numbers will ever stop blowing my mind when you talk about any sort of educational professional dealing with or attempting to really engage with that many kids. 180 was what she said when she was at Mamaroneck. 180 kids trying to kind of make all those dreams come true and really kids into a school that's going to fit them and going to really allow them to pursue a life path and ambition that for them is everything. I wouldn't want to be one out of 180, certainly. And I was going through that process, and it's certainly noble, you know, that she loved doing that and loved increasing her reach in that way. And I'm sure she did a great job with it. But, you know, I just wonder about the numbers. To me, the number of kids that a professional deals with, engages with in a particular semester, really paints the picture as to what that experience is going to be on a very structural level. Where do you start with a student who is in treatment and seeking college programs, or somebody's maybe perhaps on a non-traditional path already?
So I think that's an interesting question. And if I could just kind of break it into two pieces. Some of the students we're working with are in therapeutic environments and applying directly to college or transition programming. Some of the students we're working with have gone to treatment, therapeutic programming, and have re-entered a more mainstream environment and are looking to college, right? And so in some ways, there's a big overlap because they've had these struggles that they need to somehow address within their application. And we need to identify schools that can appropriately support them based on where they are in their journey at that time.
Right.
But it's certainly different somebody coming directly out of a therapeutic program as opposed to a high school program, depending on how long the transition has been for.
I mean, it sounds like those are the first two sort of questions that you need to answer. Now, do you have some favorite programs that you have for kids that are coming out of these therapeutic programs? I mean, you know, what kind of institution do you look for with these students?
So it's a really good question. And I think it really depends on what the student is ready for and what their primary struggles that we've identified moving forward will be. So some students are ready only for a transition program. And transition programming is designed to ease your way into higher education or even be a long-term solution. So in a traditional transition program, you're taking not a full college course load, you're living in supported housing. So you might take two classes. A lot of these programs are set near universities. So the house might be a couple blocks from campus or right on the edge of campus. Mm-hmm. And you're getting continued mental health and maybe substance use support in order to get your success. And a lot of those students also work or volunteer in their extra time. Like AIM House is a program in Boulder. So those students can go to a tech program. They can go to the community college. They can go to UC Boulder. And they provide a non-college track, but they also can work with my students who want to take college courses and get the support. And for our families, they love that because ultimately you can try to transition into UC Boulder, right? And continue to have your network of students from that program. So that to me would be the most supported starting point for taking some college courses.
Is that like the same tuition as like a regular college program?
Oh. No, but it could be more.
More? All right. I was just curious.
Because you're paying for the college credits. And again, a lot of these programs will connect to a community college. So you could pay pretty affordable credits to get your feet wet to see if the level of college work, if you're ready for it. But in a place like UC Boulder, you'd be paying the out-of-state per credit, plus paying for the programming
Right.
Which is such a great transition for our students who are in a primary treatment facility and we're not just ready to say, go live in a dorm, good luck.
That's a big jump.
And so this is the kind of medium step where you hope that they will work themselves back into that community. Some of them never live on campus. Some of them choose apartment housing. And some of them use these programs and then transfer. I have a student right now who's out west, and he's looking to come back to the Northeast and be closer to home. And he feels like he's really grounded into his academics. He knows what it takes to be successful. He's had the support he needs.
Nice.
Everybody's thumbs up on it, right? Like, it's ready to happen.
Have these become more popular recently, particularly with the pandemic?
I wouldn't say necessarily the pandemic. And perhaps there will be more moving forward. There was an increase in it. And I think the increase happened prior to the pandemic, but definitely as we saw an increase to the failure to launch group of students. You know, we used to say, even in our practice, we would say, oh, well, we treat up to young adults. And that was 24, right? Like 24 was kind of our young adult. Now we will have phone calls from families with a 30-year-old. And we'll say, well, we don't do 30-year-olds. And they say, no, they have only taken a couple college classes. They're, you know, still living at home. They've never really had a job. And so that's more like a 22-year-old or a 18-year-old than a 30-year-old.
Yeah. I mean, I guess a prefrontal cortex doesn't fully develop until 25 or 30 even. I mean, you know.
I think that's 100% what we're seeing too, which is that, and we saw it before COVID. I think it was exacerbated by COVID because I do think everybody paused. So it was more normal to have a 25-year-old in your house. And then, you know, 2 years later, you're like a 27-year-old and people like, so I think it was happening already. And so these programs, young adult programs in general, have really emerged because of that increased need. That's one less traditional way to start your college career. And then there are programs that are like Mansfield Hall would be a really great example of a program that resides, it's a private program, but resides very close to campus, on campus. So they have three campuses. One is UVM, one is UOregon, one is Wisconsin. And they support their students. They provide housing for their students.
Full course load there?
Yep, that would be a full course load. I mean, some of the students take a reduced course load, like many students who are entering college anyway.
Three academics.
But they really support their students in a more traditional way. It looks more like college. It feels more like college as opposed to the transition programming feels more like a hybrid.
Is there a name for those, that type of program? Is that categorized as anything in particular?
I think they would maybe still consider themselves a transition. That's a great question. I don't actually know what they, maybe just a supported.
They should. I mean, they should designate themselves, I would think.
I don't really know. I'll talk to Jake Weld about that. And maybe he'll be like, Meg, of course we have a name. It's blah, blah, blah.
Right.
So, yeah. And then there are programs that are supported within the colleges, right? And those tend to be more academic in nature, more learning. And look, there are ones that support ASD students, and those can have more ADLs, acts of daily living. A student who maybe needs help remembering to brush their teeth.
Do colleges have support for that kind of thing?
That if they have a specific program for certain students who,
Wow, that's intense. Yeah.
But it's a piece of the executive functioning, right? It's a piece of life coaching, integrating, you know, launching, all of that stuff. There's been a huge increase in what we call recovery campuses. And those are sober living options on college campuses. And it's not a health and wellness dorm, because what they realized is parents sign kids up for health and wellness dorms. And, you know, you could end up with somebody who's had zero life experience and just wants to be in a non-party environment. Sober is somebody who's had the experience and chooses to be sober. And so these recovery campuses or communities have been really, really cool to watch grow and develop. And so it's great to be in a recovery community. They're doing experiential stuff with the students. They are running meetings with the student. You know, it's really creating a community on campus in an environment where substances are prevalent, you know, a safe community for these kids. And this, the research and stats around it are awesome. Around their GPAs are higher, their graduation rates are higher.
Not drinking themselves silly, I'm sure.
So it's been motivating for universities to be like, ooh, we should have one of those.
Right. Help your metrics right there. Yeah.
Absolutely.
What type of challenges do you encounter with these students? What's the kind of the hardest part of the process of sorting that out that they found?
It's really different for each student, but if I had to pick one that kind of crops up a lot, it's being realistic, right? There's a lot of magical thinking, especially with a student who has been properly supported. Sometimes they don't even realize how supported they are. And so they think, I'm good. I'm ready to go. And they really are, as long as we continue to give them the support they need to be successful. All of us get support in life, right? And it's recognizing when we need it, where we use it, who we get it from. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's definitely, especially with younger students and the, you know, parents will say, well, they don't want to ask for help, or they don't want to go to the reading room, or they don't want to blah, blah, blah. And it's,
right. You
understand the need to push back. But also I'll say to students, like, I can't do my job without my team, right? And I certainly don't want to be a business without a partner. Like, I really love having a partner, and I lean on him and he leans on me. Mm-hmm. So I think working with students to recognize they don't have to do it alone.
Yeah.
But they have to recognize where the help is coming from and what really works for them. And, you know, just as full transparency, we figured it out with my son during COVID. My middle son is dyslexic and had been supported all through school. And so when we got to COVID, and it was the end of his sixth grade year, and he kept saying to me, come read this to me. Come sit with me. Come blah, blah, blah. You know, and he had zero independent learning skills.
Yeah.
And we never would have known it because in school he would say, come sit with me, and someone would sit with him, or he would say, read to me. And it was a blessing for us because we were able to help him become a more independent learner over that period of time.
One thing that stuck out to me in the second segment of my conversation with Megan was her description of the transitional programs, which offer an opportunity for kids to take maybe part-time two classes and to live in a housing perhaps sensitive to the substance abuse, for instance, or, you know, a house of really kids who are in the same position, who are having some of the same struggles, some of the same challenges. And to be able to do that in a sort of muted way seems like a really smart model to me, especially considering how many kids struggle going to college for the first time and changing everything about their lives, everything about their academic picture, everything about their social spheres. You know, that is a big radical shift at a vulnerable time. So I love these transitional programs in almost every situation. And then obviously she got into some of the other programs that are available along the spectrum as well. But certainly if I was a parent of a kid trying to get back onto a traditional path, coming on and out of treatment, I would take a long look at programs like that. Another thing that stuck out was the description of how kids that have had accommodations can really struggle when they get to the college scene. I found that to be quite true, particularly given that college structures for accommodations in terms of the 504s, IEPs, etc., you know, the way that they're sort of processing those are radically different from K-8 or high school education, you know, and the way those are used is entirely different. It depends on the school, of course. Obviously, there are some schools that are a lot better about dealing with it institutionally, but that can be abrupt. No longer having those accommodations or having to seek them out yourself and not really knowing how to do that or having the tools to figure out what those accommodations are and where to get them, I think that can be abrupt, as can not having those accommodations once you've secured them and then left college and gone on into the workplace, into the world. That can be abrupt too. So I think it's important for parents to be able to make that perhaps a slower process of sort of weaning off. We use the analogy of training wheels. You don't want to just rip those off and throw your kid down the street into traffic. That is a philosophy of rearing, I think, left us, thankfully, in about the 50s. Throw the kid in the deep end. So I think that's important when you're talking about accommodations, to be a bit slow about perhaps taking those things away.
So, I mean, we touched on this a little already, but how have things changed basically in your business since the pandemic?
So this is such a hard question because the therapeutic community is going through such significant transition right now.
Can you explain that?
A lot of programs are closing. There was a huge boom during COVID. Programs were very full and running really well. I think between the insurance creeping in and the shorter term, you know, 30-day programming, the challenges of finding staff was a really big issue for a lot of programs. So they had to keep their numbers low in order to keep the staff ratio. Mm-hmm. So there's just a big transition. And I think it's like everything. It's pain before growth. I think that it's, you know, watching programs close is heartbreaking. And good programs. We've lost some really good programs. Mm-hmm. But I do think that it will evolve into an even stronger position, which is what it's done across the trajectory of treatment. So
prune the bush.
Yeah, which stinks when you're going through it, right? It's hard. So I would say on that end, we're struggling to find, and where programs are stepping in are kind of smaller, supportive, traditional boarding schools might be willing to take one or two students that we otherwise would have sent to a therapeutic boarding school. They are, you know, they can manage that in a small classroom setting in a high touch environment.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, it strikes me as you're describing this that it's all the more important to have somebody who knows exactly what's going on with these programs, who's struggling to meet their numbers, who is not, who is looking to expand, who has troubles with staffing. I think having a very nuanced understanding of those programs would really help strategically.
It does. It does, for sure. And that's what we do, right? And those are the phone calls we're making and having conversations. It's also making sure, I had a client from a client, if that makes sense, said to me, my friend told me that if they don't want my kid just the way they are, like we shouldn't put any spit polish on it, right? We want to be really true to who they are. And if the school doesn't want them or doesn't feel they can serve them, then it's not the right environment. And I am like, yes, something I have said to these parents is working. Because right. So many times they want to edit the report. They want to kind of gloss over the bumps that we've gone through. Right. And that's not serving the school and it's not serving the student.
So it's almost like the non-fits are just as important to understand as the fits.
Absolutely. And a lot of these students have had multiple fails in their life. So I'm super sensitive to not putting them in a position of failure, right? That is a reinforced pattern that we need to break for them.
If you had sort of one parting piece of advice for parents of students who are looking at these options, what would that be? What's one core thing they should kind of keep in mind as they enter this process?
I always say, you know, God willing, life is long. And some people have a direct route to where they think they're going, and some people make multiple stops along the way. And neither is good, bad, right, wrong, because a lot of times people are hyper-focused on the end result, which in most cases in our business is college, right? Getting back to college, going to college, getting into college. And so for these non-traditional families, it's really important to know that it doesn't have to be a straight line. There is no right way to do this process. Like, whether a student goes to college at 18 or 20, there's not a significant difference, you know, and look at hockey players. You know, we do it for sports and we struggle to do it in other things.
What do you mean by that?
So people will redshirt their, you know, redshirt, right?
Very targeted for sports, you're saying?
Yeah. Sure. And we have no problem doing a pre-K year and then maybe repeating ninth grade somewhere so they can get the extra year of eligibility. Yeah. And then before you know it, they're 20, right? But if we have to take a student and give them some kind of support and get them off the track and back on, that feels much scarier to parents. They feel like, but they're going to be 19 or 20 or whatever it's going to be.
That's a good point. That's a good point. I wondered about that. Yeah. With athletes, it's like, oh, you repeated. Like, you must be a big deal. With anyone else, it's like,
It's all the lens that we look at it. So that's my kind of, you know, spiel that I give. And I don't mean it to lessen its meaning, because I deeply believe it. But I also think that this process is an amazing process. The only reason I've been able to do it since the late 1990s is because it's never the same. Nobody's journey is the same. It is so individual and so about self-growth and self-discovery when done well. Mm-hmm. And so that's what keeps me coming back. That's why I'm like, yeah, let's talk about it. Let's talk about your interests. Let's, you know, get in there. So I would just say to people that that's what this is about, right? The college is a business. Put that in its own category. This is a process.
So I hear in your voice that you are talking to the kid there. And, you know, for all of the perhaps concern about parents putting too much pressure on their kids, I feel like oftentimes it's actually the kids themselves that need the most shaping, because they're not just getting it from the parent. I mean, it's not the only source of pressure. I mean, I think a lot of it's coming from internal drive and just looking around. I mean, just looking around at their peers, at their society, the expectation, the subtleties of this world that is increasingly, you know, go, driven.
Yeah, I think it's peers. I think it's culture. Students have told me, teachers will say, oh, well, I thought you'd go somewhere better, right? So I'll say to kids all the time, it's such an Amerocentric approach to college, right? That like, if you can't get in, you should want to go, as opposed to find your place and go where you belong. It's not the whole country who's kind of bought into this, but it's very prevalent in a lot of our society.
Here are some final conclusions that I had after my conversation with Megan. One thing that really stuck out to me was the state of some of these programs today. I think there's been a lot of change, as she's mentioned. A lot of those residential type programs, therapeutic programs, have shut down, have had to close their doors due to the economic circumstances. And there's been a reduction in numbers in some places. But there's also some institutions that have experienced great success and been able to capitalize on the current circumstances based on their specialization and based on their mission continuing to be sort of an important one, but it really takes a very fine, nuanced understanding of these places. She was being fairly modest about it, but I think that can be a rare thing to find when you actually have somebody who's going to be able to navigate all of those different programs. And everybody calls themselves an educational consultant or a college planner. You know, there's really no license or degree. You know, there are some certification programs, you know, the scholastic degrees you can get that sort of support that. But all in all, educational consultants are sort of mostly self-proclaimed. So I think finding an institution like this and an individual like this who's going to be able to navigate all those types of schools, it's rare. So it's important to capitalize when you do find one. Another thing that stuck out to me was her sort of parting advice to parents, which was that life is long and there are many twists and turns, and don't fixate on the results of this college process. A fairly ironic conclusion for someone who is devoted to the college process as a method of employment. And I think that really speaks to, perhaps this is subtle, the success of this type of institution. I mean, she mentioned that they've been around since, I think it was 1970. You know, when you have that type of success as an institution over a number of years and are true to that mission of being able to serve everybody that comes through your doors, you can afford that type of sincerity. Even in the pressure cooker of a world that, you know, college admissions really is at this point, where, especially at the top, there's a lot of cutthroat approach to getting into the elite institutions of the country to make the sort of future leaders and the future earners of the world. This type of sincerity, this type of frankness, friendliness, realness, a lot of people aspire towards it, but it's not achieved very often. So that was certainly refreshing and, you know, certainly something that I will look for when my kids start to enter the college process, which will happen very soon. But as far as the par for the course, already a bit late to get into college. But I did appreciate the sincerity and frankness, and I really got a very clear sense of Steinbrecher from talking to Megan.